All right, Real Estate Talk Podcast, Season 2. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Got some great interviews here today for you guys. Financial professional and, mortgage lender, reoccurring guest. But some familiar faces here. Stay tuned as we get into it. And welcome back to the Real Estate Talk Podcast. Rob Kyleman.
Joshua Britt.
All right. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We got some special guests here today. Going around the room, we got Mr. Adam Morgan. He's a financial professional from Freedom Point. And Jeremy Berrios. He is a mortgage loan officer from Movement Mortgage. Guys, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us here, guys. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Thank you again.
All right, Adam, let's begin with you. Welcome to the show. Could you tell me a little bit about yourself, your experience, your background, how you got into this?
Yeah, absolutely. Got into it by complete accident. Coming out of college, all I knew is did not have a whole lot of connections to climb the normal corporate chain and like the idea of working for myself. Figured I'd never be poorer or more positioned well to satisfy what it takes to start a business. Love solving problems, so ended up in the financial industry at the end of 2004. So I've been in it for almost 20 years now, and every year is a different challenge, a new challenge, and still learning something every day.
All right, fantastic. And Jeremy, tell me about yourself. How'd you get in that loan business and providing financing for those who want to buy?
Very awesome. Much on accident. And I think I've said that a couple times, for the previous ones, but mortgages just isn't a sexy word. You're quote unquote putting people in their largest debt that they'll ever obtain in their life. And you have to strategically do that in a way that's safe, careful, and responsible for all parties involved. But kind of the same thing. I grew up very, 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 very poor. Wanted to understand how money works. And was very interested in finance, was going to school for that, was actually briefly under the tutelage of Adam Morgan for a brief time period, but learned a lot. He's become a great friend and a great mentor, just one of the best people you just ever meet with. So I'm lucky to be here just, in his presence, to be honest. And after that season, I transitioned into mortgages just from being in that business. Introduced me to another acquaintance that was in the mortgage industry, and I got, into the mortgage industry after I transitioned out of the financial planning realm. So it's kind of helped me understand the financial planning aspect has helped me with the mortgage side, kind of create a holistic plan, for them, for my clients. So it's been great.
Oh, nice. Awesome. And ladies and gentlemen, don't forget this episode is sponsored by Closer Coffee Company, fresh roasted coffee for closers. Buy closers, fuel your hustle at closercoffeeco.com. That's closercoffeeco.com. Take it away, Joshua.
All right, so Adam, if someone is getting started in financial planning, what is the first step they should take with their financial planning journey?
So great question, Josh. And the first thing that I would always encourage people to do is to really understand why you're doing what you're doing. So many times we talk to people who've been introduced to us and they're coming in because a concept has driven them there. But the reality of it is the concept isn't what is important. So an analogy I always like to use is when you build a house, right, you go buy hammers and saws, you get the tools to build the house. You don't build the house because you want to go buy the tools, right? Mm-hmm. Insurance products, investment products, tax planning, legal structures, these are all tools, right? They're not the house. The house is cash flow. Understand that when you're doing a financial plan, when you're optimizing a financial plan, the reason you're doing the things you're doing is about cash flow, either strategies to create it or strategies of resolution of the loss of it. But the cash flow is what you care about. Make sure you're working with someone who understands that. Make sure you understand it yourself, and that's going to lead you most likely to a better outcome than just focusing on a specific silo or product.
So I have one follow-up question. You talked about cash flow. And for those that make – I don't know what questions are asked to you, but do you get any questions from people like, hey, yeah, I want to do an investment, and what are some of the common misconceptions or that you hear maybe people aren't aware of, they got maybe bad gouge from watching Flop or Flip or whatever it is on HGTV. Do you have any insights on that?
Yeah, so a couple things, right? So one, the biggest mistakes I see that happen in the financial world are when people do things that they're not comfortable with and they don't agree with, but it's because someone convinced them to do it or scared them into do it, right? We tell people that first you got to understand the core philosophies that are important to a successful financial plan. Cash flow is your greatest financial resource. Just like building a house, you don't build the third floor first. You build the foundation.
Right.
Foundation is addressing the primary ways cash flow stops. There's four. You know, one you choose, three you don't. Every financial decision is interdependent, not independent. When you try to make an independent decision, sometimes you create inefficiency. And then most importantly, in life, you need three things. You need shelter. Human beings evolve beyond the capacity to survive the elements. You know, if you don't believe me, just watch Naked and Afraid. These are survivalists. They can't even last 30 days. I ain't making it, right? Yeah. You need sustenance, and we're not perfectly efficient. You need to expel waste. I don't do any of those things, right? No financial person does, right? So everything you do from a financial perspective is a want, not a need. Mm-hmm. Don't get scared into a decision. It should be an empowering engagement, not a fearful engagement. And when you bring all those things together, what you'll find is a lot of the times people make mistakes. They're afraid of missing out. Mm-hmm. They're afraid if they don't do something of the negative consequence. But they're not empowered to say, here's why I want to do this, right? Death, disability, these things suck, right? You just don't get around it. But when you plan around them and say, hey, it makes me feel good to know that I've gone through a process where I know the thing that I'm doing to resolve this risk provides those whom I care about with what I want, how I want. That's empowering. Mm-hmm. Take an optimistic outlook. And the same applies to investment decision making. Why am I making this investment, right? You don't have to do anything. You don't have to do a retirement plan. You don't have to do a stock or a bond. Mm-hmm. They're tools.
Yeah.
How does this pertain to what you're trying to ultimately accomplish? And is it moving you closer to the goal or further away? Do you understand what you're doing and why? Or has the person presenting it to you scared you into it? Like, that's a big barometer I found. Most of the time when you find people make an investment decision that they want to make, they end up with a better result. Secondarily, don't wait to take a step, right? One of the biggest mistakes people make in investing, besides being made to choose a decision that they didn't want to choose, is they're waiting for this magical moment. When I make X, I'm going to plan. After I get married, once I have my first kid, right? First of all, when I first started at this, I made just enough money every week to pay for food, groceries, auto, and rent space to do this every week, right? Mm-hmm. And I would actually drive back down to the Outer Banks and bartend for the weekend because I didn't make jack doing this, right? Mm-hmm. It takes time.
Yeah.
So I still saved $25 a month, and then I saved $50 a month, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone can save. Mm-hmm. Everyone can save. And it doesn't have to go into investments. Put it in the bank. Mm-hmm. Create the habit. The habit's more important than this. If you create the habit, you're going to get this. If you ever look at some of these farmers that made 30, 40, 50,000 in their a year in their lifetime, I grew up in the country. I saw this. They retire multimillionaires. Why? Because they developed the habit of strong savings first. That strong savings led to liquidity. Liquidity gave them the leverage and the opportunity to take advantage of the right opportunities when they presented. And most of those opportunities presented themselves because other people didn't have the liquidity. And they now lost that opportunity, right? So make decisions from a positive place, not a negative place, right? Mm-hmm. Understand a core philosophy, understand why you're doing what you're doing, and start. Mm-hmm. Start.
Okay.
Wow. That was a lot. A lot of great information in there. Now, how should someone choose a financial person that they want to work with?
Great question, Josh. So first and foremost, when people come to me, a lot of times, you know, there's buzzwords, right? In our industry, there's buzzwords. Financial advisor. I think the new soup du jour is Wealth Management Advisor, that's the new one. I love that one. That always gives me a giggle.
Seen that in like Fisher commercials.
Oh, it's just brilliant, right? It's all psychological plays on what people think would land. But the reality of it is most of these folks are siloed, right? I don't ever tell people I'm a financial advisor unless I'm at a Christmas party and I want them to scatter. And if that doesn't work, I say, hey, we also do insurance, right? They're gone. Because the reality of it is, if someone tells me they're a financial advisor, that doesn't tell me what they do, right? What are you advising me on? Someone comes to me, I tell them I'm a financial professional. They say, well, what does that mean? I'm like, well, what we do is we look at creating strategic financial plans that are optimized for an outcome, right? Most of my clientele are business owners and entrepreneurs. And like, what does that even mean, Adam? I'm like, well, think about it if you went to a symphony, right? If you look at all these different instruments up there, you got flutes and clarinets and you know, brass instruments and percussion instruments and all these different things. And if they all just started playing, it's going to sound like a train wreck, right? It would. But that's not what happens. You got this person who comes out and understands the instruments, understands how they work, and properly brings in the woodwind and then the brass. And all of a sudden, you've got this wonderful melodic experience because everything is integrated optimally to create a desired outcome. That's what a financial professional should do for you, right? They should know more than just a tool. So first and foremost, look at them and say, what is your strategy? What are you going to be doing for me? And is it a whole bunch of buzzwords like a wealth management advisor? Or do you actually understand how do the tools work? How do the tax strategies work? Are you interdependently looking at the things I do and how they work together? Or is all of your planning really siloed? And for me, what I find as a business owner, it is impossible to be effective with a business owner if all I'm doing is asset management, right, or an insurance strategy. It just is because I'm just leaving hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on the table from an inefficiency perspective, that's the best rate of return you can ever get, right? So one, what's their philosophy, right? Is it interdependent or is it independent, right? Find out pretty quickly. If you go to someone and they can meet with you in one meeting and then tell you how to fix all life's problems, that's usually a big red flag for me, right? I mean, there's a lot of people smarter than me out there, a lot. I used to joke, and Jeremy heard this way back in the day, but I'm like the crosshairs of mediocre, right? Average height, average size, average intelligence, average athleticism, average looks. Like, I'm just as mediocre a human being as God has ever made. I just chose not to stay that way, and everyone gets that right, right? So you don't have to find the smartest, most brilliant person. It's just, are they spending time with you? Do they have a strategy that's not siloed, right? And I can't figure that out in one meeting. We got to meet and just see if we're a good fit, right? So first case, are they going to meet with you before they start charging you a fee? Are they going to spend time to say, hey, let's just connect and make sure, are we a good fit or not? Because I always feel like I may not be a good fit for what they want, right? You want me to solve all life's problems, and don't get me wrong, there are people out there who can give you answers after first meeting. I'm not the guy, then I'm not your guy, right? So know what you're looking for. Are they going to spend time with you and engage you to find out who you are, what you want, and figure out if you're a good fit, right? Are they going to look at it in an interdependent way, right? Are they going to focus on the why behind what you're doing in the cash flow? Are they going to focus on wants versus needs? And are they going to create an empowering environment versus a scare-based, fear-based environment, right? Those are the red flags I always tell a client to look out for, right? And if you find that person who's more process-based versus transaction-based, if you find the person who's more interdependent, if you have the people who understand that the why is cash flow and they're going to do it from a positive perspective, those are usually good signs that you're with the right person. Mm.
Okay. So what are the most common mistakes people make when investing?
Oh, gosh. We don't have enough time for all that.
Your top five. Yes. Or top three.
So first, here's the biggest, right? The biggest is making an investment decision because someone told you to do it versus understanding how it does what you want it to do.
Yeah, right? So mom told you to do this, or dad, or your best friend.
That's right. Mom, yeah. Dad, the water cooler talk. The financial advisor said do it. Great.
Some guy on TikTok.
That's right. MSNBC says you need a Roth IRA and everyone needs a Roth IRA. No, you don't. It's a tool, right? If you're cutting a board and someone says, hey, since you're building a house, you need a hammer. Well, the job you're working on is cutting a board. The hammer's going to do a pretty crappy job.
Sawing wood.
Yeah. So was that your fault because you said you were building a house, or was it the person who gave you a hammer when they should have given you a saw? Know what the purpose of the investment is. Mm-hmm. How does it effectively move you toward what you want or what you don't want? Right?
Yeah.
So that's the first biggest mistake. So many people do things and they don't really understand the why behind what they're doing and how. Every single tool, I cannot stress this enough, because every year there's some new silver bullet, right? Every single tool that exists has a pro and a con. There is nothing that in and of itself is the right thing for everyone in every scenario. There just isn't, okay. Right? So that would be number one, right? Number two is the understanding the biggest enemy when you make an investment decision. It's not the market. It's not your tenant if you're a real estate investor.
Yeah.
Your biggest enemy, you have to bring him to the forefront, or him or her, will be, you know, give it everyone there, right, is emotion. It is you. You are your biggest enemy in investing. And what I mean by that is there is a gentleman who won the Nobel Prize in 2017, Richard Thaler, for emotional biases. And the precipice of everything he says is that human beings, while logical and objective, make illogical, subjective decisions all the time, and they root it in false objective facts. So the example I'd use is if you flip over a coin and it lands on heads, naturally we're predispositioned to believe the next flip has a higher probability of being tails than heads. Or let's say I flipped the coin over three times and it landed on heads every time. You really think the next time we subconsciously believe it's a higher probability of being tails. No, it's not. The same.
It's like going to the slot machine almost.
It is. It's so the same thing when we look at it is someone says, hey, I'm completely comfortable with a super aggressive risk tolerance. Let's go full bore at it. Great. You're comfortable when you put 1,000 in, right? So let's talk about understanding what risk tolerance is, right?
Yeah.
Risk tolerance is standard deviation. It's volatility. So if you're investing in that S&P 500, you got to accept the fact that in any given year, you might be down 29% or up 49% because you got to move three standard deviations away, right? No problem on a 10% variation when I put in 10,000, right?
Yeah.
I can tolerate 2,900. Ah, what about when it's a million?
Yeah.
290,000 is still 10%. It's objectively the same, but subjectively that number move is bigger. That's an example of emotional biases. Understand, you will be your biggest enemy. You cannot, we're just not wired not to be that. And be aware of it and understand when emotional biases is creeping in and do your best to overcome it. Or more importantly, if you know that that's going to creep in, design the plan in the beginning with the end in mind, because that's a huge effort. We saw so many people lose money in 2008. Hopefully and thankfully, I don't think most of my clients, but lots of people came to a who pulled out at the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just 08. Guess what? It happened in 2020.
Yep.
It happened in 2022. And the root of all of it was their financial person didn't help them understand the emotional side of decision-making when it comes to investing. And that's not just in the equity markets. What about the real estate market? In 08 and 09, how many people jumped ship on properties that if they had held them till today?
Yep. Wow.
Are massively more valuable.
Well, we saw that in the run-up to the pandemic when, you know, and when we hit in 2020, it just seemed like people lost their minds and just all wanted to buy houses all of a sudden, and it just caused a huge increase. So that, in that situation, is that kind of playing into the emotional aspect of doing maybe possibly right or wrong decision-making?
FOMO, right? Yeah. Fear missing out, right?
Yep. Yeah.
I've always wanted to be a real estate investor, and I didn't, and now I've got to buy this house, right? Well, great, but is it a good investment? Is it doing what you want it to do? If the answer is no, then don't. If the answer is yes, then do. Well, houses are too expensive today. Okay, is it doing what you want? Is the investment? There are people still making money in the stock market, in the real estate market, in every market. And there's always going to be the next opportunity, right? There's never that once in a lifetime is a circular thing. And guess what? That once in a lifetime is going to be in some industry and somewhere, somehow next time, right? FOMO is an emotional biases, right? That fear of missing out. You got to just say, take it off the table. Mm. Understand what I'm doing. Understand what I'm trying to accomplish. And be very focused on, are you moving towards what you want? And then analyze it from that perspective. So you absolutely saw it, right? And now everyone's waiting for the fallout, right? There may not be a fallout.
No.
Right? There may not be a fallout because everyone subjectively says everything went up too high. It must come now because of 2008. What caused 2008 is not going to be the thing that causes the next move, right? It's a different animal. Don't get emotionally tied to something without fundamental data that supports it. And so many times that happens.
I had this one time. I met this guy at a coffee shop, and he had to have been 56 years old or something like that. And he's like, I want to get into a real estate investment. And I'm like what, like a rental? Or do you want to do a flip? Like, what are you looking at? He wanted to do a rental, but, we did a little, some things. I said, okay, this will give you $300 cash flow. This would be that, this and that. And he says, well, that's not enough. And I was like, well, then you got to buy a house that needs tremendous amounts of repairs, and you got to buy it low as you can go, and then fix it up and then rent it out. Then you'll have higher cash flow, but you have money invested though. So he didn't like that either. And he asked me, well, is there like creative financing where everybody can just pull money together and we can all just buy a house together? And I was like, not that I have set up for for that, but.
So it's funny you say that. I've heard lots of things over my career. And one of the things that another very successful financial strategist I know up north said to me, and he was actually speaking at an event for some of us, and he said, the shortest way to success is the longest road. Mm-hmm. Everyone's looking for a get rich quick. Mm-hmm. There is no get rich quick. Even the one of our firm's clients, and I won't say anything other than the fact that this person was involved in an organization that people would typically connotate that, right? Multi-level marketing, right? Even that is not a bad place to make money if you're committed to it. Mm-hmm. The difference is if you think you're going to do something for 2 hours and you're going to make yourself a millionaire, that's just not true. this person put in 60 hours a week plus for a decade. Now everyone sees him and they're like, oh, he's the guy making millions a year. I have yet to find the person who worked 10 or 20 hours a month in the beginning and was a multimillionaire on the back end. There's no shortcut, right? Same's true with investing. If you're going to get into something, you've got to learn it. One of the more successful real estate investors I worked with is a client. And people would look at this gentleman and always say, man, everything he touches turns to gold. Mm. Everything. He always makes money. And we were talking to one, he's like, you know why I'm so successful at real estate? Everyone thinks it's because I know how to buy a property right. And he said, it's not that. I know all the ways that if you buy a property, you're going to lose money because I've done that. Mm. And I've learned how to weed out all the ways that will cause failure. And if I can't find one of the ways that cause failure, then the odds are I'm probably going to be successful. He learned that from experience. And I can say personally, in my investing, any investment person in any avenue of investing, whether it's real estate, whether it's the equity markets, whatever, if they haven't experienced something that went wrong, that's scary to me. Mm. I've had lots of success in real estate. I've had lots of failures in real estate. I've had lots of success in the equity markets. I've had lots of failures in the equity markets. Those things are experience. Experience creates capability. So make sure that finally, the final piece I would say is there's no shortcut. You have to start somewhere. Don't keep getting ready to get ready. That's another big mistake people make. Mm.
Okay. So how should people think about financial planning as their lifestyle changes, like new jobs, marriage, kids? How does their financial planning, for that need to change?
So great question. First and foremost, start with the end in mind. if you're building a financial plan today and you're young, you're in your 20s or 30s, right? Our hope is we're all going to make it to the 50s, 60s, 70s, right? And most likely, in so many instances when I talk to a client, going back to the biases, we make decisions based on our relative position in life at the time. Without the concept of, you know what, I'm going to think differently in 10 years and 20 years and 30 years. Hindsight is a beautiful thing. It's very, very effective when you look back at all the things you should have done, right? The problem is you can't apply it to what you're going to do. But what you can see is the way I thought when I was 20 is different than I think today, right? So when you're looking at a financial decision, you should say, one, why am I making this decision? How is it moving me towards where I want to go tomorrow, today? And is the financial decisions or the collective of financial decisions I'm making creating an optimal outcome for that tomorrow with the flexibility that as tomorrow comes and changes, I can change the plan without completely scrapping it, right? So if I have to look at a financial decision I'm making and saying, hey, this worked really well when I was 25, but now that I'm 40, it's completely different. I'm going to have to redo it all. That introduces inefficiency. Inefficiency is one of the it is the silent killer in financial optimization. So many times, again, the short road, everyone's looking at how to make a money, make a dollar and make money. And they're not looking at, well, what are all the things I'm doing that are suboptimal?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And what if I just improve those suboptimizations over the next 40 years of my life? What does that look like? In some cases, that's five figures. Six figures, and I've even seen some of the larger cases where it's a seven-figure move in a person's net worth. Well, that's a certainty. Why am I not spending any time on my financial strategy developing that? So think about your financial plan should be optimal for what you want. It should be cash flow-centric, and it should be flexible enough. And you should say it's not about if, it's when life changes, because it will.
Mm-hmm.
Is my plan designed in a way where it can be effective in multiple different scenarios? And if the strategies I'm using aren't, then I need to be a little bit more focused on other options.
I'd like to briefly touch and kind of piggyback on that. And not only because I've come from that world, and so everyone, full transparency, you know, I let Adam's firm, you know, control everything that I do, but it's because I philosophically believe in everything that they're doing. And it's no different from a financial plan to when, again, I'm helping someone with a real estate portfolio or anything else. Adam and I talk about this at length, right? And this is philosophy. As a spectrum of lifespans, what you want today will change tomorrow. And it has to be flexible and nimble enough to change as certain life perspective happens. When I'm 21 years old, I don't believe that death and taxes are a thing. The chances that I wake up tomorrow and I retire is 0.00%. Right? The chances that I wake up tomorrow, I drive out of my parking lot and I hit a physician who's going to sue me for human life value, which is only a term that attorneys use, right, in a court of law. I want to invest in real estate, right? That's the house, right? It's the cash flow, right? If I can't protect my cash flow tomorrow, what does it matter what tool I'm using to invest it in if I'm not protecting the other two areas of the financial plan, right? Which is the cash flow and the protection firm of it. And it's so crazy how we don't think about how's that going to change, right? And what did I look like? And when I first, you know, started thinking about that and, you know, I had a bunch of personal experiences or drivers for that, you know, so many times now in the days of social media, when someone passes away from an unexpected car accident, a diagnosis from this, because death and disability are, unfortunately, they're the mundane and they're very morbid topics, but they're certainties in life, right? I don't want the government deciding my kids are going to get X amount of money upon me passing. They are accustomed to a certain lifestyle now, and my wife is accustomed to a certain lifestyle now. How do I ensure if I leave this podcast now, I get on Lynn Haven Parkway and someone T-bones the crap out of me, that there is something set up in place where they're not worried about their college, they're not worried about their house, they're not worried about anything. Like, mourn me. Don't mourn the entire financial process of what's happening, right? And that's the biggest miss that people just don't understand, right? So again, it's How do I make the house efficient? Forget the tools. What's the end goal there? And if people don't get that.
Yeah, I would say, I think there's probably two things that, you know, people kind of think. Like, they think, like, there's some secret to money and investing, and it's only reserved for, like, the super wealthy type people.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing is it's like, I'm either too old or I'm too young to worry about it now. If you're starting, let's say you're 40 or 50 years old, you're like, I missed all those years. Like, is it worth it to start investing now? Or like you said, I'm in my 20s. Like, you know, I'm not really worried about saving. So, like, I guess that question is for Adam. Like, how would you handle that if someone comes in and or you're speaking to somebody who's like, I think I'm too young or I'm too old to start worrying about investing now? Like, how would you handle that?
So actually what you said is true. There are secrets. They're just not that secret. People think they're secret, and they're maybe not as exciting as people want them to be. So they're looking for something different, right? One, habitualization. One of the most important things we teach people from a financial perspective is the habit you create can either be good or bad, right? Addiction is a habit, right? Drinking, drugs, some of the other things, the unspeakables. Working out's a habit too, right? I know tons of people who are addicted to working out. It's just the result of that habit has a better outcome than if they drank every day. Habitualization can be a benefit. It is a benefit, especially if you habitualize the right things. Savings rate should be a habitualization. I care infinitely more about understanding the psychology of a person, paying attention to the psychology of a person, and helping them implement the right things. One, save the right amount. Habitualize saving 15% of your income, it will disappear. It takes about 8 months. But if you save 15% of your income, no matter how painful it is today, and by the way, I've yet to meet a successful person who got successful doing all the things that make them uncomfortable, making a new habit's uncomfortable. In fact, one of the rules, and Jeremy may remember this, but one of the rules in our office is every single day you have to do something that makes you a little uncomfortable, because if you don't, you're not growing. Mm-hmm. Every single day. That me included, right? Growth lives in discomfort. Habitualize the savings amount. It won't be uncomfortable soon, after about 8 months. And here's the shocker. I don't even care about the systematic savings except for the habitualization of the factor, because then I know you've implemented something that drastically improved your probability of success. We've analyzed clients for me and one of my other partners who's an analytic nerd like myself. We've analyzed for about the past decade, and what we have found that anyone who saved 15% of their income and they had started doing that below the age of 45, we've never seen a single one of them end up not being able to have the same or greater net cash flow in perpetuity when they wanted to stop actively creating income. Not one. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter where they put it. Did they put it in the stock market? Did they put it in a savings account? Did they put it to real estate? Didn't matter. Just that. So one is habitualization and understanding that. And then two is understanding the value of the exponential curve. Habitualization is the seed that leads to the tree of the exponential curve. I ran an example. I ran for one of my clients. His kid was 18 years old. He owned his own business. We said, let's take $6,000 a year, put it into a Roth, right? Even if you, because they were like, I want to do something for my son. He's doing all the right things. I'm like, great. Put this in. We said, let's run it from 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Right. We did 5 years, $30,000. And then let's say he never saved anything else again. Let's use an average rate of return. Now, you know, averages are they do not predicate future returns, right? Historical returns do not predicate a future return, right? Disclosure there. But we ran as an example, say what we felt was a very reasonable average. And we said, that's all he did. And we looked at him at age 67. And then we took someone who was age 47 to 67, and we said, let's put $20,000 a year away. $30,000 versus $400,000. The person with $30,000 had more money than the person who put away $400,000. That's the law of exponential curve. The sooner you get a pot, the longer that pot has to grow, the more that outpaces. And eventually, that is more powerful than the systemization. So all these people who wait to do something don't realize you are making it so much harder on yourself. You would have been way better saving $100 a month 40 years ago than you're going to be saving $1,000 a month today.
Mm.
Right?
So this is, I'm listening to everything that you've been talking to us about, and you hit on the points of, you know, the emotional aspect of it, where you're at in life, yep. so to speak, some type of people's expectations and whatnot, and what maybe family members or friends are telling you what to do. So here's something I see all the time. You know, this is all on social media, right? Or you see this in Reddit forums. Hey, Shiba Inu crypto coin is going to the moon. Everybody throw your money in there now. I've seen, oh, look, GameStop stock. Oh, my God, I made $40 a share off GameStop. You guys got to get in there now. And you see these all over the forums. And then I think I was just reading off Twitter or X now, formerly Twitter. NVIDIA is crushing it right now. So this all seems like hype. You know, to me, dangerous, not dangerous. How do you see that? You know, with these, because I heard this, and I'll loosely quote this from Jeff Bezos. Okay. Jeff Bezos said, if you are waiting for the wave and the wave happens, that's great. If you're trying to ride the wave when the wave's already formed, it's too late.
Yeah. So, even to add to that, one of my favorite, sayings is from Warren Buffett, said when others are greedy, I'm cautious, and when others are cautious, I'm greedy.
Mm-hmm.
When you're taking advice, mm-hmm. especially in today's world, one of the biggest problems that we live in today is also one of the biggest benefit. The speed of information has never been greater than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is information has a ugly twin called misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
So as the speed of information goes, so does the speed of misinformation. Many people hear what they want to hear, and a lot of these things, going back to the psychology of it, speak to easy money, quick.
Mm.
And everyone has a reference to someone who did something who made a bunch of money, right? The problem is you just don't hear about the 90% who didn't.
Yeah.
If it looks too good to be true, usually it is. I go back to, I always understand what I'm doing and why. Cryptocurrencies and AI and all these things. Don't get me wrong. There's a place for everything. What am I buying? Why am I buying it? Do I understand it? And I've always had a big belief that if I don't understand something, I'm not going to put my money in it. Because I can make enough money in the things I do understand. And if I really want to put money in something that sounds great, I'm going to spend time learning it, actually learning it. Not some other hype person who saw the same article you did just 6 months before you and now they're your mentor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Show me your result.
Yeah.
If you're telling me I can be a millionaire of this, you show me your bank account where you're a millionaire from this. Mm. Show me the result. Take your own poison. Same thing with financial planners. If everyone's saying it's the greatest thing in the world, cool. You do it. If not, why not? If it's great for me, why isn't it good for you? There may be reasons, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
But I always want to know that, right? If you're telling me I need to save 15%, but you're one paycheck away from bankruptcy, okay. Why don't you follow your own advice then?
Yeah.
You know, the people who say Shiba is going to the moon or all these other things. And then who knows? Maybe the meme stock, right? Meme stocks.
Yeah.
Had people asking about all of them. Right. And this, of course, is not any advice to buy meme stocks or cryptocurrencies. Consult a professional. And I am not giving anyone blanket advice to buy them. But what I can say is everything that was happened didn't match at all up with fundamentals. When I looked at the fundamentals, I understood why volumes were moving. It just had no fundamental basis. So for me, I can't logically tell someone to invest in this. Could you make money? Sure you could, because everything's happening irrationally. When does the game stop, right? If I'm playing a game of musical chairs and the music stops and I realize, oh, there's no chairs, we're all just going to lose. Everyone is still in the game when the music stops. That's not where my money's going to go, because that is not, you know, I know where Vegas is. I'll take a plane trip out there. It'll probably be a little bit more fun. So with all these things, there is always going to be changing trends. And when changing trends come around, there's an opportunity to make money. But if you want to make money in it, learn it. And don't learn it from somebody's friend's friend who thought it sounded really cool like you. Verify that they're a subject matter expert. Get advice from people who actually have a basis to know what they're talking about before you throw money. And don't throw money at something you don't understand that you can't afford to lose. Right? Don't. Yeah.
Everybody gets their information from the University of Facebook with a PhD from TikTok and YouTube.
That's right.
You know, yeah. Again, you know, as quick as information comes out, there's a lot of disinformation, you know, out there. And I think, you know, we talked a little bit about the financial entertainers like, you know, Susie Orman or even the wonderful Oz that people call Dave Ramsey, which I probably agree with, I don't know, 15 or 20% of the stuff that he says too, especially when it comes to like the mortgage world and stuff like that. But everybody has a microphone in this day and age with social media, and they have that platform, and that makes it just very, very dangerous, because if it's on this and this person who I believe is credible and they view things the way I view things, oh man, then it has to be true.
That's right. Be wary of the affinity sale. Trust but verify, and spend the energy. If you like something and you love it, it doesn't mean you shouldn't invest in it. Learn about it. Learn from a credible resource. If someone comes to me and says, I want to know about cryptocurrency, I'm not your guy. Not going to do it. And I know enough to be dangerous. I'm not your guy, right? So just be careful. Don't gamble with money you can't afford to lose. And make sure that you verified, am I getting information or is it slewed into that misinformation pool that's just as equally powerful?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, you know, talk about you need to diversify your portfolio, or you need to diversify your investments. And I think that's why some people take chances on things like crypto and that. But like, what's some sound guidance that you can give about how to diversify your portfolio the right way?
So absolutely. Now that I agree with 100%. I believe there is no financial tool that doesn't have a pro and a con. Immunization is a very big thing. So when people say I have a diversified asset portfolio, I'm like, great, what do you got? Yeah, large cap stocks and mid cap, small caps. Okay, you've got all stocks. That's not a diversified asset pool. You've got diversified stock investments, right? So I have found that the more successful people are, the more they have different pools, right? They're going to have market-driven assets, right? They're going to have non-market-driven liquid assets, things like bank accounts, CDs, savings, municipal bonds. They're going to have other conservative asset tools like various forms of cash accumulation insurances, right? They're going to have real estate, residential, and commercial, and they may even have passively held businesses. Everything has a cycle, right? If you look at 2022, for example, terrible time to be in a general equity, right? Great time to be in an energy equity, or a great time to be in real estate that, you know, you got a great rental income and you got a great. So everything, just like in certain cycles, it's the opposite, right? You know, in 2009, it was a phenomenal time to be in the equity markets. As well as 2010, not the greatest time to be in a real estate portfolio, right? Everything has its cycle. Diversify yourself in a way that you can immunize yourself to any market trend, and you can weather it, right? If you've diversified yourself into an investment that requires your capital flow, and if things fall apart, you can't afford to do it, be wary, right?
So how has technology kind of, you know, there's a lot of technology that's out there, and some people are saying, like, I see on like Instagram reels, like, oh, there's this software that we developed that all you got to do is just put your money in there. It's going to automatically manage it for you. I'm not subscribing to that. But, you know, how has technology helped you in what you do every day to help enhance returns for your clients?
Yeah, so everyone in the financial world has benefited by the improvement of technology. We've improved systems for client management and client relationship. Just the improvement of technology has drastically created efficiencies in the ability to manage money on a larger scale basis. What that does is twofold. One, it gives us time back, and time's the most powerful and most valuable of all resources. And two, it allows us to pass those and should allow you to pass those cost efficiencies on to the client, right? In our world, there's this concept called fee compression, which means the cost for people to hire money managers is going down. So it should translate, right? So that's one of the things you want to look at. If you've got a guy and they've been charging the same fee for 30 years, well, why? Technology's made it more effective, right? So just pay attention to what is the technology that the client is using? How is it engaging you? How is it allowing you to be more efficient as the advisor? And how is it allowing the client to be more efficient with their time? Technology should make it very easy. We've got a tool that a lot of my business owners have to do a personal financial statement every year for their bank lines. It's one of the most miserable things business owners do. Technology's evolved to the point where part of our financial planning software is they literally go online. We've got everything set up. They just hit a click and they've got their personal financial statement. So what used to be an hour and a half of misery is now 30 seconds to a minute. And that creates efficiency. That gives them back time, making them more productive.
Okay. So, you know, everyone's talking about AI here and, you know, the enhancements of it. You know, do you think or could you speculate on, you know, whether AI is something that could one day take the place of you, for example?
Everything's possible, right? That's the good and the bad. Everything's a possibility. It's just what's the probability? There in the financial world, there's objectivity and there's subjectivity.
Oh, real quick, can you get closer to the
sorry.
Mic? There you go.
Sorry. In the financial world, there's objectivity and subjectivity, right? The biggest problem that creates so many decision trees for people is there's really no truly purely objective decision because emotional biases, as we talked about earlier, comes into the decision-making process. No matter how good the AI is, we have yet to see a scenario where they can fully encapsulate the subjective nature of the human being in its fullness to ever fully replace the value of having someone who understands who you are, what you're doing, and why you want to do it, right? Even in some of the areas where it's becoming more prevalent, like the risk management in the insurance arena, the decisions on some of those are still majorly made by people.
Hmm.
And until that, someone somewhere is making a decision, and having one human being who can communicate with another human being has value. So who's to say what the future may hold? But true financial planning. Now, will AI probably replace some of the base transactional-based pieces of the financial world? Yeah, probably. But the true financial planning, we haven't seen anything happen yet where it could ever fully encompass the value of that human capital and human input.
You know, I looked at something where I don't understand this completely, so I'm loosely talking about it, but where they have it set up where AI will automatically make your trades for you.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure how that works. I don't know if I would trust that because based on my understanding of AI, it's based on pre-programming. And what if somebody was to use that? I mean, because that could be really dangerous. Somebody could use that for nefarious purposes. If you pre-programmed your AI to make certain type of trades and you knew that about the software and you did the opposite trades, you know,
that's a really good point.
We call that conflict of interest, which is why most financial people that you'll find, for instance, people are like, well, what are you buying today? I'm like, well, I'm trading for clients. So the answer is I'm buying nothing because we're not supposed to trade on the same day we trade a client account because it could create a conflict of interest. So you're absolutely right. There's still so much that remains to be seen when it fully plays itself out. It's an interesting time. I definitely think AI is going to enhance the cost, the efficiency, the value to not only the end client, but to the financial planners who are using it properly. It's going to be a value creator not a competitive piece to worry about. My opinion doesn't mean I'm right or wrong. It'll be interesting to see how it unfolds.
There's also some fear in it. That's why I brought it up. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
You know, we fear what we don't know.
Yeah.
And that's one way to look at things. But it's also, I think once you realize if you know how to do something and you know how to do something well, scarcity dissipates and the acceptance of abundance becomes more prevalent. And once you accept abundance, it's just like, well, I don't know what's going to happen next, but I know how to create value. There's always going to be an opportunity to create value.
Okay.
Okay. What type of insurances are essential for comprehensive financial planning?
Oh gosh. So insurance is a bad word in my world. even though it's a necessary world, right? So I always tell people it's about risk management, right? We tell people focus on the cores, right? The core: auto insurance, home insurance, umbrella insurance, which goes over auto and home. It's just that blanket because most people don't realize the exposures they have in it. Health insurance, disability insurance, and we always tell people understand the definition, duration, and taxation. The most valuable asset any of us has is our ability to create income. It's the thing that creates everything else in our life, and more times than I can count, I'm like, great, the one thing that protects that most valuable thing, what does it do and how does it work? And very, very often people can't really articulate to me. That's something we always want to get to the bottom of. Life insurance, and then estate planning tools. And even though estate planning tools are more legal documents, we still see them as a risk mitigation. Those are the cores you want to have. Everything above and beyond that is a supplement, right? You need that foundation. You need that first and second floor. You need a kitchen. Mm. You don't need the granite to be in the kitchen. Once you've got a kitchen, then you can decide if you want to put the granite in the kitchen, right? So
nice.
Do the kitchen first, then look at the supplements on the back end.
Mm.
Okay, so let's talk about like financial literacy. Like, is there any books or, you know, what should people be looking at in order to help increase their own financial literacy and understanding of it?
Yeah, I mean, so there's all types of great pieces out there, right? As I mentioned, understand the objective and subjective, right? There's a book by David Kansas, which is called The Wall Street Journal Guide to Money and Investing. One of my contacts at a large institutional gave me this and said they used to have it as prerequisite reading for all their guys. It's 200 pages. It will bore you to tears, but you will learn a lot of fundamental stuff and it's worded in a way that you can assimilate it, right? There's the Psychology to Money and Investing, and the author escapes me right now, is also really powerful. And then I also think there's great – most of my clients are business owners and entrepreneurs, so there's also great tag-ins that are really helpful because you have to understand the why. A lot of times financial decisions are A, dot, dot, dot. D, right? Mm. Do you guys, and I don't know if this lands with the viewers, so I love South Park, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was this one called the Underpants Gnomes, right? And the boys ultimately get these Underpants Gnomes that they're stealing Cartman's underwear. Turns out they know a ton about business. They got to write this business report, right? So y'all know about business? Yeah, great. So they go and they said, so tell us how business works. They're like, oh, that's easy. It's three steps. Collect underwear. Dot, 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 question mark, profits. And then all of them scream, profits, right?
Yeah.
So many times when people make investment decisions, like that's what they do, right?
Yeah.
I got to do something. There's this weird amorphous thing I don't understand in between. And then it leads to success. Success, right? Yeah. Well, let's create correlations. Let's understand why A means B and B means C. And then C equals to D. And now there's more of a correlation. So it's objective data that you need to understand, but then you need to understand the subjective. So Psychology of Money is great. Wall Street Journal Guide to Money and Investing. And then I love just some general psychological sides to understand. Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Covey is one of my favorite things. Mm-hmm. Just absolutely can't say enough good things about it. Who Moved My Cheese is great. Mm. The Oldie But Goodie.
Short book.
Yeah. The Energy Bus. Absolutely love the Energy Bus, the Go Giver. Lots of these are really good just to get not just the objective facts you need, but understand the psychological approach you need to be successful.
Hmm. All right. So what are some common tax planning strategies that people often overlook? We're talking about making money, so obviously that comes with taxes.
Absolutely. So understanding how your taxes work is important. Understanding whether you should be itemizing or not is important. And understanding that the way you flow things can change the efficiency of how you use it in a business and personal space. Now, always have a good CPA. Strongly encourage people to have a good CPA and do tax planning, right? Tax planning does not occur March for the year that you just passed through, right? Tax planning occurs in July and August and September of the year you live in. And when you're a business owner, it's vitally more important. But understand the tools that are out there. Understand how you're flowing money through your life. Understand if the way you're flowing money through your life and the way you operate yourself from a taxable perspective is optimal, or if there are other ways you could do it, and then look through the decision tree. There's more depth that comes into play, especially when you're a business owner, the entity you have and how it works, how you're employing people, what's a bona fide business expense, are you doing annual corporate minutes? Spoiler alert, everyone who owns an entity should be doing their own corporate minutes. You leave yourself so exposed when you don't. Another conversation for another time. So all of those can have value.
Cool. All right. I think I got one last question here. Right. Oh, you got something?
No, go ahead.
Oh yeah. And it is, where do you see the future of financial, advising going?
Yeah. So who knows?
I love that.
I think that, and this is my own opinion, and sometimes people in my industry would call me a heretic, but I think more people are demanding more engagement. They're demanding more service, which they should. Financial advising for so long has been a transactional industry versus a collaborative process. And it should be a collaborative process. Effectiveness is so much more powerful in a collaborative process. I think the general population is, because of the speed of information, they know more to ask and how and why. They're demanding more. And that's going to lead to a better positive outcome in regard to service. I think people are going to really grasp, and I think the industry should evolve to more of a service-driven industry than a transaction-based industry. So that's what I hope happens. And that's what I hope when people are hiring a financial professional, that's what they're looking for. A service-based relationship, you will just get so much more value than you will from a purely transactional engagement. My opinion.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is kind of like how it's been in the past. It's like, hey, Adam, here, I got some money over here. Just handle this for me, and I'll check back in with you in a little bit and see how it's doing. Versus you see it being now more of a, in the office, you and I sitting down talking and doing a lot more planning. Is that kind of where you've seen it go?
More collaborative, interdependent conversation. It's not just about the money you give me. It's all the other things it touches and how are those all moving collectively together. It's just a deeper review, right?
Awesome. All right. That's it. That's all the questions you had. All right. Let's go around the table. Anything you'd like to add, Jeremy? Anything you want to put out to the listeners out there?
No. I mean, I just thoroughly enjoyed this entire conversation and this entire topic that Adam had. It's so true. Especially again, just with the information and disinformation and then the use of AI and all that stuff out there. Especially in the mortgage industry, everything is how do we get costs down, because the cost to do a loan, is so expensive and stuff like that. And, as long as companies keep in mind that it's supposed to be more cost effective to do the mortgage, to pass those savings on to the consumer, but not leaving that human element. So whether it's financial planning, and I still believe that doing mortgages is part of a financial plan, because there's lots, to do with that. If you can't pay your mortgage, if you die, who's responsible for your mortgage? Again, pregnant like cash flow, just real conversations that you have to have. So I just think as the financial tools can get more complex, and some of them aren't. Some of them are still very basic, but you still keep that human element in doing what's fiduciarily correct and right for your client at all time.
All right. Adam, you got anything you'd like to add?
No, I mean, you nailed it, right? There's always an opportunity. Mindset is so important. Live in a place of abundance. Live in a place of interdependence. There's no shortcuts. And just eat the frog. Accept the fact that there's no shortcuts. Life is so much easier when you accept the fact that if I just put in the work, I'm going to get the result.
Yep. Eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? Okay. That's the old saying. Everybody, if you like this video, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. Give us a like. Leave us a comment below. Let us know what you think about the podcast. With that, thanks for watching. See you soon.